Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening. Thank you for coming tonight. My name is Misha Stone from the Reader Services Department. Welcome to the library, and thank you for joining us this evening. It's a pleasure to welcome Stuart Onan to the Seattle Public Library. Thank you to the University Bookstore and Viking Penguin for inviting us to host this reading. Thank you also to the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs. Finally, a special thank you to the Seattle Public Library Foundation, whose support makes possible so many of our free library programs. Stuart Onan has been the author of numerous works of fiction and nonfiction over his career. I do want to mention there's a lovely timeline on his website about how I became a writer when I used to be an engineer. That's worth checking out. His debut novel, Snow Angels, was later made into a film in 2007 with Kate Beckinsale. He went on to write, to name a few, Names of the Dead, A Prayer for the Dying, The Circus Fire, Last Night at the Lobster, Songs for the Missing, Emily Alone, and co-authored Faithful, Two Die Hard Boston Red Sox Fans Chronicle the Historic 2004 Season with Stephen King.
That's a terrible subtitle. It's an awful, I mean, why would they put that on there? Let's just say Faithful. Faithful, that's it. That's all you need. I hate that.
I can see you'll change that at some
point.
Editors. The year that last... What's that? Sorry. The year that last...
Let's go Bucks, yeah. I'll explain.
The year that Last Night at the Lobster came out, pretty much everyone in my department read it and handed it to reader after reader after reader. We told book groups about it. We're still telling book groups about it. Last Night at the Lobster and Emily Alone are the kind of books that you just want to tell person after person about. And I can't tell you how many people have come back and thanked us for telling us about those books and about Stuart Onan.
First me. Thank you. Thank you.
And the thing that's really great about Onan is that he keeps surprising readers. He never writes the same book twice. And most importantly is that everything that Onan writes is full of compassion and dignity, both in the characters he writes and the stories he tells. But some writers do even greater good than give the world great books. They also promote other wonderful books and authors, both living and dead. And Stuart Onan has done that with writers such as William Maxwell and Richard Yates. And when my book group discussed Last Night at the Lobster several years ago, I stumbled across his wonderful essay on Richard Yates, The Lost World of Richard Yates in the Boston Review, which is really worth reading. And I wanted to quote from, but you really want to hear Stuart instead of me. Like Yates, one of his favorite writers, Onan writes about real people and doesn't skimp on the hard realities. You'll see this is true in his new book, The Odds. Welcome, Stuart Onan, and thank you for sharing the stage with me.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Why the Pirates hat, right? I'm from Pittsburgh, born and raised in Pittsburgh, and my grandmother was a Pirates fan. And I'm a big Pirates fan. I'm a season ticket holder. I only became a Red Sox fan when I moved to Boston. So the Pirates are my first love. The Red Sox are my adopted love. And because I was a Pirates fan, I was used to Roberto Clemente and Willie Stargell and winning. and Kent Tekulve, yes, Teak, who does the color after every game now for the Pirates. And they're such a terrible team. This year will be the 20th straight losing season that they have. They're awful. They're dreadful. And yet, they're ours. We still love them. We'd hate to lose them. You guys having lost the Supersonics, right, you never get over that, ever. So as long as the Pirates are in town, I'm going to support them. I'm going to go out there. And even if I hate the ownership, it's still my team. Actually, I'm going to start off with Western PA. I'm going to read the very first bit of Snow Angels from my first novel. This is my money-back guarantee. If you go out and buy Snow Angels and you do not think it is a good book, get in touch with me, and I will give you your money back. Cash money, dollar for dollar. I won't do that with any other book, but Snow Angels, I can stand behind it fully. There it is. And I approve this message. Chapter 1. I was in the band the fall my father left, in the second row of trombones, in the middle because I was a freshman, Tuesdays and Wednesdays after school, we practiced in the music room, but on Fridays, Mr. Shervenick led us outside in our down jackets and tasseled steeler hats and shit-kicker boots, and across the footbridge that spanned the interstate to the middle school soccer field where, like the football team itself, we ran square outs and curls and a maneuver Mr. Shervenick called an oblique, with which, for the finale of every halftime show, we described all 122 of us, a whirling funnel approximating our school's nickname, the Golden Tornadoes. We never got it quite right, though every Friday Mr. Shervenick tried to inspire us, scampering across the frost-slicked grass in his chocolate leather coat and kid gloves and cordovans to herd us into formation until, in utter disgust, instead of steering a wayward oboe back on course, he would simply arrest him or her by the shoulders, so the entire block of winds had to stop, and then the brass and the drums, and we would have to start all over again. Late one Friday in mid-December, we were working on the tornado. Dusk had begun to fill the air, and it was snowing, but Saturday was our last home game, and Mr. Shervenick persuaded the janitor to turn on the lights. An inch or so had fallen during the day, and it was impossible to see the lines. "Wrong, wrong, wrong!" Mr. Shervenick shouted. When the girl pulling the xylophone slipped and twisted her ankle, he blew his whistle three times, which meant we were to line up for a final chastising pep talk before we could leave. He climbed the three steps of his little wheeled podium and let us stand in silence for a minute so we would realize how disappointed he was. Snow piled up in our hair. Beyond the sea of flakes drifting through the highlights came the ringing drone of a tractor trailer's chains on the interstate. In the valley, muffled by a ceiling of clouds, lay the burning grid of Butler, the Black River, the busy mills. "We have all worked very hard this year," he said, and paused, breathing steam, as if speaking to a stadium, waiting for his words to circle. Beside me, Warren Hardesty muttered something, a joke, a rejoinder. And then we heard what I immediately identified from my own 22, my father's Mossberg, the nightly news from Vietnam, as gunshots. A clump of them. They crackled like fireworks, echoed over the bare trees on the other side of the highway. They were close. The band turned to them in unison, something Mr. Shervenick could never get us to do. What we had heard was someone being murdered, someone most of us knew, if dimly. Money-back guarantee. When I first started writing, a lot of the stuff that I wrote was very dire. Terrible, terrible things happened to people, seemingly at random. A lot of this, I think, came from reading a lot of Stephen King and Flannery O'Connor together. So you had the sort of, you know, the vengeful O'Connor and then the gleeful sort of gross outs and violence of King. I think I've gotten a little calmer since then. And Emily Alone, I think, is the culmination of a lot of that sort of calmness and the quietness in the books. I'm not going to read from it tonight, but it's a sequel to another book called Wish You Were Here, which, as my wife calls it, the big boring book. This is the smaller boring book here, and hopefully less boring. So give that a try there. I think everybody has an Emily in their life. I'm going to read from the new book, since it is the tour for the new book, and I'm going to read two excerpts. The setup of the odds is that Art and Marianne Fowler have lost their jobs. They know that they're going to lose their house, and they're going to lose all their money, and they're going to have to declare bankruptcy. They live in the suburbs of Cleveland. Things have not gone well, and for Valentine's Day, Art has decided they're going to go on a second honeymoon to Niagara Falls, and they're going to take what's left of their savings out of the savings account and go to the casino there and put the money down on the roulette wheel. And if they win, then they can stay together. If they lose, then they will get divorced, and Marianne will then be able to protect their assets, according to Ohio State divorce law. So the marriage has been sort of quietly on the rocks for many years. 20 years ago, Bart had an affair with a woman named Wendy Daigle. And when it broke apart, he confessed this to Marianne, and Marianne has never forgiven him for that. Marianne, for her part, is very ambivalent about the relationship, and she now sees that possibly this weekend is a way to very easily and almost passively get out of the marriage. She has had, more recently, an affair with a woman named Karen at her work, and yet has not confessed it to Art. So Art's hope is that they're going to get back together, and this weekend is going to just fix everything. They're going to go put the money, they're going to win, it's going to be Valentine's, it'll be a second honeymoon, it's going to be great. Whereas Marianne's hope is they lose, and very quietly they sort of separate and go their separate ways after almost 30 years of marriage. Every section is prefaced by the odds of something. And this section is prefaced by the odds of the sun coming up one in one. The next morning, as if to erase the night before, they made love. He was tentative yet pesky, rubbing against her. She was barely awake. "Seriously," she said, since his excitement had nothing to do with her, but gave in, sleepily hiking up her nightgown. "Try not to press too hard on my stomach." "I won't," he promised, and then paid too much attention to honoring the request, locking his elbows so he hovered above her. The bed was less giving than their pillow top at home, and his wrists hurt. It had been so long he was afraid he would explode, and proceeded slowly. The heat of her always astonished him, as if deep inside, like the earth, she possessed a fiery core. He was quiet, deliberate, focused on her forehead, her eyebrows, the hollows of her collarbone. She tipped her chin up, and he descended to kiss her throat. His breath was sour, and she turned her head to one side, closed her eyes as if to steal a few more minutes of sleep, murmuring with pleasure to encourage him. His lips on her neck stirred ticklish beginnings. Too soon, he pulled away from her throat, but she wasn't invested enough to correct him. She peeked and found him working intently, his face slightly pained as if he had a toothache. As he quickened, she arched, squeezing her arms against her ribs to push her breasts together, a trick that never failed. He seized, clenched, then exhaled, let his head drop. They chastely kissed, politely traded their most solemn pledge, perilous any other time, yet exempt here, as if this space were sacred, staying together till she patted his side to let him know he could roll off. The room faced east, and the curtains were edged with bright sunlight. "Looks like it's going to be a nice day," he said. "Oh, I thought it already was," she said, and excused herself to use the bathroom. He lay back in the pillows, dazed and emptied from his efforts, limbs splayed, contemplating the rough popcorn ceiling, his mind wiped clean. Right up until she lifted her nightgown, he hadn't been sure she would have him. After 30 years, she was still inscrutable, and while normally that was frustrating, it produced in moments like this an abject gratitude, a feeling of having been rewarded spectacularly for enduring those long, brittle stretches of indifference. He was pleased enough with his performance, she'd seemed happy with it, and congratulated himself on his persistence. He was convinced there was a lesson in it. No matter what happened, all he needed to do was keep trying. In the bathroom, cleaning herself, she knew it had been a mistake, undertaken casually, without thought of the consequences, as if this were any other weekend. She had to be more careful. Making love was a way of laying claim to each other, both of them openly agreeing to renew that bond. After all of their problems, she wanted foremost to be honest. Her fear was that after the fact, he might accuse her of premeditation. But their habits were so entrenched, and she didn't want to hurt him. She figured it would hold him till tomorrow. "How's your stomach?" he asked when she returned. "It's okay. Where's the clicker?" "By the TV." She grabbed it, and he lifted the covers to let her back in. Since neither of them was working, they developed the bad habit of sleeping late and watching TV in bed, checking the news and weather, then surfing her cooking and home makeover shows. Here, she didn't feel guilty about it and indulged herself, seeing what the barefoot Contessa was making. "Wonder how late the buffet serves brunch," he said. "Oh, you're not serving me breakfast in bed?" "We could. I'm just kidding." He went to the bathroom, then paraded in front of her to open the drapes, letting in the blinding light. He stood there like a hairy cherub, admiring the view. People are already out there taking pictures. They've got horse and buggy rides. All she wanted to do was watch her show. But no, he needed her attention. He was such a boy. "Why don't you go take your shower?" she said. "You want me to holler for you?" "No, I want to see how this turns out." Once he was gone, the bare stage of the room made her excuse all the more glaring. He was playful after they made love, frisky, yet she felt no residual giddiness, no surge of energy, only fatigue and a vague bitterness. She wasn't angry with herself so much as at her expectations, that once again she'd fooled herself into doing something she knew wouldn't help in the long run. She'd felt the same way with Karen at the end, but then she'd attributed it to guilt and the stalemate of their situation. Now there was no one she was trying to be faithful to but herself, and she couldn't even do that. In the bathroom, he was singing. She muted the TV to hear. "Try to understand," he crooned. "Try to understand. Try to understand. He's a magic man." They were seeing Heart tonight, a band he mistakenly thought she'd like when she was a teenager, because he'd like them when he was a teenager. As he did the solos, ridiculously impersonating the various instruments, she lay there listening, clicker in her lap, not understanding how he could be that oblivious and that happy. Both of which, she thought, were at least partly her fault. So yes, I'd like to dedicate this reading in Seattle to Anne and Nancy Wilson, of course. Thank you, Anne and Nancy Wilson, for many years of great listening pleasure to classic rock. The second section I'm going to read is the Heart concert, since why not? We're in Seattle. God love Heart. You're not here tonight, Heart's not here, right? No? Nancy, Anne? I was hoping. It would have been great. So instead of them singing it, I'll be singing it. What you need to know for this section is that Art, because the money's funny money anyway, has taken 10,000 of it and bought an engagement ring for Marianne, hoping to propose again to her, to ask her if she will be his wife again. And so he has this ring in a box in his pocket. He keeps looking for the exact right time to give it to her. On the bus ride up, across the aisle from them, was a couple of bikers, or a man and woman in biker gear, and all the way there they were making out, which that happens on the bus from Cleveland. And of course, Marianne looking over was disgusted, and Art looking over was jealous. There. The bus itself was almost involved in an accident, which scared the hell out of them early on in the book. And before this particular scene, they ate dinner in the revolving restaurant of the Skylon Tower. It's always a good idea not to eat dinner at a revolving restaurant. Nothing against towers or needles or anything like that. But while they were in there, Art thought that he saw Nancy Wilson, the actual Nancy Wilson from Heart. He was convinced it was Nancy Wilson. This was a big, exciting thing for them. They were on vacation. They saw Nancy Wilson. And so they stayed there to eat instead of just sort of like having a drink there. And so they stayed there. They had a lot of fun. And they've been tipsy and sort of been drinking for a while now. They went back to the room and drank. They drank on the way in. And they're just having a big, big night there. And after the concert, they're going to do a dry run of the roulette table where they're going to try out the Martingale method, which is sort of a negative progression where if you lose, you double the bet, and if you lose again, you double the bet, and if you lose again, you double the bet. And as long as you win within those first five tries, you're okay. So they're going to do this right after this, and it's been weighing on Art all along, because even though he's come up with this idea of gambling, he's a very, very timid person. This is the only other thing I'm going to read. It's going to take, I think, around 15 minutes, so settle in. The odds of Heart playing Crazy on You in concert, 1 in 1. Even as they waited outside in the bright, sterile mall, shuffling toward the theater doors with the other latecomers, most of them their age, Art noted, the reek of burning weed was overpowering and brazen. He'd forgotten it was legal here, or at least decriminalized. Marianne sniffed the air and arched her eyebrows like Harpo. Inside, a fog hung in the trusses overhead, reflecting the kaleidoscope of the light show, and he wondered how the owners got around the fire code. When a joint came down their row, she hit it and passed it to him as if it was natural. He held the smoke in his lungs, watching Nancy Wilson strumming her 12-string and stepping forward to press a pedal, her skin tinted yellow and then red under the gels. Her hair was only shoulder length and straight, not the luxuriant tresses he remembered, and she was noticeably thin, as if she'd been sick, her wrists bony. Though he'd sworn it was her, the woman from the restaurant had been someone else. It wasn't the first time he'd gone out of his way to prove he was a fool. This was minor, comparatively. He exhaled, adding his breath to the cloud above. Beside him, Marion swayed to the music, the crowd singing along so loudly he could barely pick out the vocals. It was like being trapped in a giant karaoke bar on Heart Night. For years, he'd been hearing that dope was stronger. Now he believed it. He'd been drinking for hours, so maybe it was the combination. His lips were numb, his face a rigid mask, as if he were slowly being paralyzed. He felt himself receding, a flickering brain cell trapped inside a thick, inert head, like the lighted stage at the end of the dark auditorium. He watched the crowd as much as the band. They played two or three favorites, then a new tune nobody knew, everyone settling again as if in protest. Someone down the row must have had a bag of joints because they just kept coming. The smell was piney, sweet. Marion coughed and laughed at herself, offered it to him. He needed to be in control for the dry run later, and rather than abstain and look like a lightweight, he took in a shallow mouthful and blew it out. The new tune garnered tepid applause, and then the stage, the whole place went black, as if they'd lost power, only the red exit signs floating in space. In the dark, people shrieked and whooped and whistled, called out songs. After a long minute, a single orange spot found Nancy Wilson downstage, perched at the very edge, one high-heeled boot atop a monitor, her right hand raised straight in the air like Pete Townshend about to windmill. She waited till the shouting and the catcalls subsided, lowered the pick to her Stratocaster, and broke into the galloping opening riff of Barracuda, making everyone jump up. She played it twice, three times, torquing the whammy bar, bending the last jangling cord so it ricocheted off the walls and scattered, then spun, kicked, and the flash pots bloomed like fireworks, blinding as the rest of the band jumped in, thunderous, hitting them like a wind. "So, this ain't the end, I saw you again," Anne shrilled. Marion grabbed him, and though he had no idea how to dance to the song beyond a head-banging pogo, and understood they looked as ridiculous as all the stiff middle-aged baby boomers around them, he tried to match her enthusiasm, sticking out his chin and pouting, Jagger-like, lip-syncing to the words he didn't know he knew. Her smirk was a challenge, half put down, half come on. They mock-taunted each other with the chorus. "And if the real thing don't do the trick, no, you better make up something quick. You're gonna burn, 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 burn to the wick." The coda was all churning guitars and flashing strobes. After the last cymbals crashed and the lights died, they embraced, sweaty, celebrating the greatness of the song and how wasted they were. When she kissed him, he tasted weed and tequila. She hung on his neck, shouted in his ear, "Is there anything left to drink?" He made it his mission. There was no sense in both of them going. His mouth was dry, and he had a craving for a beer anyway. As he'd predicted, the lines were endless, the concessions people painfully, irritatingly slow. He didn't mind missing a couple of cheesy power ballads, but while he was still a dozen people from the front, he recognized from a lifetime of AOR radio the finger-picked flamenco intro and then the strummed build-up giving way to the big, fuzzy, falling-down-the-stairs riff, "Crazy on You." "We may still have time, we might still get by." The song could have been about them, and he wished he were there with her for it. Part of the reason the line was so slow was that they had to check everyone's ID, which made no sense given the crowd. He shifted from foot to foot, looked to the ceiling for patience. The waiting was giving him a headache, and then when he reached the counter, incredibly, all they had was light beer. They were $10 apiece, and he could only buy two. He didn't tip his server, then felt guilty, which pissed him off even more. He took a sip from each beer so they wouldn't spill and hustled across the concourse, skirting the steady stream and leaving the arena. The band was playing another new song no one cared about. As he made his way down the aisle, he passed dozens of people texting on their glowing cell phones. Back at the seats, Marion was doubled over, her head twisted, one cheek pressed against the seat back in front of her. A woman he'd never seen before knelt beside her, shining a flashlight app around like she was trying to help. He thought Marion had passed out and blamed himself for leaving her. And then she straightened up, smiling goofily, pinching something tiny and glinting between her fingers. The woman cupped a palm to receive it, tilted her head, and refastened her earring. "Oh my God, thank you so much," she said, hugging Marion like a long-lost friend. They were both completely stoned. She was from the row ahead of them and bumped him as she slipped past, spilling the beers. "You're gone a while," Marion said, taking hers. "Well, I heard crazy on you. What else did I miss?" "Nothing too exciting. All they had was Bud Light." "That's fine." It was a waste. By the next song, his beer was gone. Marion swayed along to Alone, but for him, the mood was ruined. His back hurt from standing. It had to be 9:30. No way they would go 2 hours. He counted the songs they'd played, thinking they must almost be done. He imagined they were saving Magic Man for the encore. As they ran through their later lesser hits, he expected every song to be the last. He pictured the casino teeming with people, the blackjack dealers calmly revealing their hands, servers bustling between tables with free drinks. Between songs, as Nancy was switching guitars in the darkness, Anne strode to the front of the stage. "Now we know it's not Valentine's Day, but we're not here tomorrow, sorry. So we'd like to wish everybody a happy Valentine's Day, all right? All right. This is a special night. Niagara Falls is a special place. So before our last song, we'd like to bring two special people up here to do something special." She checked her cheat sheet. "Please welcome Tom Rutkowski and Allison Spagnota. I hope I got that right. Tom here has something he wants to ask Allison." The crowd cheered as the couple walked on, and for a moment, Art felt as if he'd been robbed. He rubbed a hand over the bump in his pocket to make sure the box was still there. Why hadn't he thought of it? It seemed obvious now. A simple phone call, and they could have been up there instead of these two, hefty, even beside Ann Wilson, and weirdly familiar. As the man lowered himself to one knee, knight-like in the spotlight, Art recognized the orange Harley bandana and leather vest. "Holy crap. You know who that is?" "Who?" Marion said. "They were sitting right across from us on the bus." "Yikes. Don't remind me of that bus." The woman said yes, and the couple embraced to a standing ovation. A gracious hostess, Anne Wilson, kissed them each on the cheek and sent them off, waving to their new fans. As the lights dimmed, then died, Art imagined the congratulations awaiting them and the happy place this memory would have in their married life, and thought, once again, through his own lack of imagination or foresight, he'd blown another chance. From the darkness, softly, lilted a synthesizer riff he associated with something bobbing in water. And behind it, revolving like the scratchy edge of a record, the crash and hiss of surf washing ashore. Gradually, the lights came up, bathing his stage a marine blue. A guitar joined in, and another synth, their twinned single notes descending slowly, sweetly. He knew the song, but couldn't quite place it in their catalog. Because it wasn't one of theirs, he realized before Anne sang a word. It was the Who's Love Rain or Me, disorienting here, a complete surprise. As a teen, he'd been skeptical of the anthem, too inexperienced and self-conscious to buy the idea. Now, on the far side of romance, he wasn't sure it was realistic, or was he unworthy of the sentiment, split as he'd been? It made him think of Wendy and the beach, the lunch hours they'd sat at the chained-down picnic tables, necking and planning a future that never happened. Marion tugged at his arm, and he leaned down. "I love this song. I didn't know they played this song." "They don't," he shouted. "It's probably because it's Valentine's Day." He wasn't sure she heard him because she didn't respond, just swayed by his side as Anne overpowered Roger Daltrey's original. At the end, both Wilson sisters came forward, arms over each other's shoulders. "Thank you," Nancy said. "And good night," Anne said. They bowed and threw a dating game kiss. "We love you." The stage went black, the synthesizer riff and the crashing waves still circling, softer and softer, till they were lost in applause. All around him, people held up their phones, a ghostly phenomenon he'd only seen on commercials and disliked on principle. The few surviving smokers raised real lighters, blatantly violating the law. He wished he had one. They clapped in rhythm. We want heart! We want heart! As expected, the band returned for an encore, taking their places. Cynically, he thought it was all choreographed, as slick and shallow as Vegas. Why did it bother him? Everyone sold out to survive. It was the price of getting old. He tried his best, just no one was interested. They surprised him with another cover, Led Zeppelin's Rock and Roll, which he danced to, feeling faintly embarrassed, while Marion flung her hair around. Been a long time since I rock and rolled. It was true. He had no moves and was already pondering which of the two roulette tables they should play. He bopped along, nodding in time, then finally gave up during Magic Man, standing quietly beside her, constrained and impatient, as if waiting to be released. Thank you. Thank you so much. It was a great thrill to write about heart. I don't know if they know. I don't know what they'd feel about it if they knew, but it was just a lot of fun. So to just bring them in, I was just thinking, who would be there on Valentine's Day? What is exactly the right band? I was like, it's got to be heart. So I had a lot of fun with it. And I had a lot of fun writing about Niagara Falls. Usually I write about parts of the country that aren't really well known. Again, my Western PA upbringing, you know, to show the country some places that aren't seen in literary fiction or in film, things like that. So I'm always sort of location scouting. But in this case, the location is almost sort of ready-made. In a way, Niagara Falls is a stage, and we all know what it is, and we all know what it means. So I had a lot of fun with it, and got to visit there too, which is a hoot. In fact, my wife and I, who've been married a long, long time, went there on Valentine's Day weekend, and we stayed the same places, saw the same things, which is very dangerous, really, when you think about it, or stupid. But it was still a lot of fun. We didn't gamble anything, though. No. Any questions at all on anything? Even the Red Sox, I've gotten over their tanking last year. I feel it's the reward. That's the reward, I think, of writing, is that you get to jump out of who you are into other people. And that's the reward I find in reading, and especially reading fiction, because I get to be inside the head of these people that I would never otherwise meet. And the question I always sort of think of when I'm writing or when I'm reading is, how does it really feel to be you? And if you're Manny, or if you're Art, or if you're Marion, if you're, you know, any of the other characters I write about, how does it feel to be you? How do you see the world? And how do you see it differently from the way that I see the world? There, what's important to you? Who are the people closest to you? That's always sort of at the front of my mind when I'm writing character. It's great while it's happening, because you're hanging out with the character sometimes for years, and really sort of interrogate, like look at Emily. A long, long time. I mean, you're hanging out with him, but then you finish and you have to sort of move on. And that's the hard thing. I think Salinger was right. He said, when you start remembering things, you start missing everybody. And that's what happens to me when I finish a book, after I've been with a character so close and thinking about them and even the smallest things that they do. Like, how does Emily get through the days? And so, I kind of miss them. I mean, the stories are still there. The scenes are still there. I can sort of, you know, visit them again in my mind. But there's an intensity to it that is the reward of going back to work every day and finding that world is there and open to you. You can walk in and be intimate and close to the characters. And that's what I love about it. Sure, thanks.
I was wondering, how did you miss?
Well, in songs, there's five major characters. There's Fran, the mother, and Ed, the father, and Lindsay, the little sister, and JP, the boyfriend, and Elise, the best friend. And I just try to imagine myself into their lives and into their worlds and what happens when Kim goes missing. I did a lot of first-person research for it, talked to people who had undergone that experience. I looked at how other people had used a missing person as sort of a narrative vehicle and saw what they did and what I didn't like about it and what I felt was mercenary, I guess, about it. And it took me a long time to actually get into the story. I'd been thinking about the story for a long, long, long time. And it didn't come clear to me until a friend of mine in Minnesota, my friend's partner's mother went missing in Iowa. And they had to go down there and help search for her, and it did not end well. And so just talking to her about everything that she'd been through, I'd always been looking for you know, what was the mystery behind the person who went lost and how did it get solved and all that. That wasn't the real story. The real story was the people that were left behind and how they dealt with it and how they were stuck on it and had to try to move forward and how they moved forward at very different rates and how those rates sort of tore them apart because they didn't understand one another. And the book then became not about the missing person, but about how little we know, even the people that are closest to us. And that became the most painful thing, especially with Lindsay, and how little she lets herself be known and then hurts because no one understands her and she isolates herself. And that became the real tragedy, I think, in the book, is what happens to Lindsay. She becomes very strong, but she becomes very hard and closed off. And that's why I kind of ended the book with her there. It becomes sort of her story that she has to take into the future, but she can't relinquish, so she's stuck with it. It was a tough book to write. It's a tough book. That emotionally, that was a tough book to write because, I mean, everybody in it is just hurting so badly. Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I've been trying to do with the last 5 or 6 books, to get away from that sort of, you know, dire, violent, big climax kind of fiction that I was writing earlier on. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but I just think it's maybe where I am in life, a little older, you know, thinking more about endurance. How do people get through it? Because people do get through it, and sometimes, yeah, and sometimes it hurts. You know, and sometimes people get through it, but it changes them for the worse, I think. Because as I got further into it, just how supportive they are of one another when crunch time comes, because they have been together against the world, just the two of them, for so long there that it's become ingrained. They can talk with one another, whereas they can't really talk with anybody else. They're very isolated, so it's always the two of them there, this pod of two. And I think as the book gets towards the end, that comes to the fore more and more there, because she does support Art, and he does support her. And there's no doubt that they recognize that they are the most important person in one another's lives. By far. Yeah. Is Emily Alona a work I've been working on for a while there? Has it been on the back burner? No, not really. Not really. I wrote Wish You Were Here back in probably 1999 and 2000. And originally, it was going to be Emily's book. It was just going to be her. But I met all these other characters and became interested in them, and I began to spread. And that sort of, it's that Tolstoyan sort of, suddenly everyone becomes interesting and everyone deserves a section. And when I finished the book, I realized that I didn't do what I sort of set out to do. I came up with something else, which I found interesting. And usually that's a sign of doing okay, because you found something different. But I knew that I still wasn't done with Emily. And so back in, I think it was 2007 or so, after I did The Lobster, I just started thinking a lot more about Emily and how she's still hanging around. You know, she's still by herself and Henry's been dead for, you know, 7, 8 years now. What's changed? What's changed in her life? And in that the time between, my mother died. And she spent, I want to say, the last 30 years of her life by herself. And I always thought that was a very sort of brave and courageous and very strong thing to do. It must have been very difficult. And so I started to think about her life and about Emily, and it just made me think, you know, let's really do this. It's a book that can't be written. It's an impossible book to write. And that's the kind of book that really kind of interests me. How is this book about a woman and her dog living alone in Pittsburgh, and how are you gonna sex that thing up? I told my agent about it. He's like, oh, okay, I guess someone will be interested. But I got fascinated by Emily and what she goes through, and kind of just pursued it there, and believed that. I mean, John Gardner said that if a character is capable of and worthy of love, then the reader will follow them anywhere. I don't know if that's absolutely true, but if you only put in what is really impinges on their true desires, their deepest desires, if you have that selectivity, then the reader will follow along and not get completely bored with it. And Emily's desires are pretty strong, and I think they're shared by everybody. We want to know if we've done okay by the people that we love, the people that are closest to us, parents, our children, you know, our loved ones, our mates. And she's got to come to terms with all of that. So it's big. I mean, it's some big, big, big stuff. But done again, as you said, with that very sort of tiny close-up, you know, extreme close-up kind of aperture. Plus, I wanted to write about Rufus the dog again. I mean, he's, you know, I just love sort of hanging out with Rufus. And during the writing of this book, we had two dogs for a long time, and one of them died. And so I was alone in the house with one dog who's left, and alone in the house all day with the dog. So there was a lot of talking to the dog. And immediately I just went straight into the book. I was like, oh, I can use that. You know, thank you. Thank you, dog. Yes. Are there film versions of any of my books coming? They've optioned Last Night at the Lobster, but they can't find any funding for it. Right now, they're in the process of maybe optioning The Odds. They've optioned The Night Country, but again, can't find money to film it. A bunch of them. Names of the Dead, that old Vietnam book from way back before. Prayer for the Dying. Great. Actually, there's a great screenplay of Prayer for the Dying. This actor is in Inception. He played the sort of the customs guard at the very end when DiCaprio is trying to come back in. He's a stage actor from Broadway mostly, but he wrote a great screenplay, an amazing screenplay. He's like, wow, I'd love to see that movie, but they just don't have any money. It's tough right now for indie films in Hollywood. When The Descendants is seen as an indie film, yeah, they went out of business. But I mean, Snow Angels, David Gordon Green, God bless him, did a really nice job. He got the tone, he got the mood, and he put it all together. It was his vision, you know, the writer director, and that's what I think is needed for some of these other smaller books. You know, a writer-director that just can maintain the tone all the way through there. But, you know, after I was very pleased with how Snow Angels came out. I mean, it doesn't use all the elements in my book. It does a lot of other things, and most of the good lines in it are actually his lines. But I was very happy with it, and I think that's kind of rare. But it's made me think, you know, maybe they can pull off something good with some of these other ones. And you never know. So, plus, I want to get paid. Gots to get paid, as Mookie said. My books are so addicting. Well, it's good to know. Intervention, you know. Your addiction has affected me negatively in the following ways. The new book, I'm just signing a contract with Viking for it. I'm doing research for it. I'm not sure how long it's going to take. It's a historical novel set in Los Angeles in the late 1930s. Get the right tone. I've got to get a feel for the time and place before I sort of plunge into it. I think I have some of the characters. I have some of the events. So we'll see. Doing research on it pretty steadily. It's going to be interesting. Again, it's one of those books that it may be impossible to pull off, but you know, I'm going to give it everything I have. Thanks. It's great to know that people are waiting for it, because usually it's no one cares. So, how do I go about doing my research? Do I have a system? Yeah, I have a typical kind of thing that I do. I do a lot of book research. I look at the setting, the period. I'm trying to learn as much as I can about it. If there are characters that are involved in a certain subculture, I'm usually drawn to some kind of American subculture. Then I'll do research on that subculture and see how people have represented it in the past and what I like about that and what I dislike about that. And I'll do just a ton and ton of usually unnecessary legwork, unnecessary research, research that actually never makes it into the book, but it sort of frames how I do or don't want to do it in a certain way. There. And then I'll talk to people that have been in that particular position, or I'll seek out first-person accounts of how it was, if it's historical, there. And I'll look for photo books of that area. And usually it takes me 3 or 4 months just to get this batch of stuff together to get me excited about what's going to happen. Then I'll sit down and I'll try to find a way into the material. At that point, either it works or it doesn't work. If it doesn't work, I'll just throw all the stuff away and I'll do something else. And that happens a lot. I mean, the story I always tell is Wish You Were Here, which is, you know, as my wife said, the big boring book. Originally it was supposed to be a parody or a satire of a big stupid horror novel set at an amusement park. And how it turned from the one thing, I mean, we went to Cedar Point, we stayed there for a week, I talked with everyone, took video, took pictures, took notes, all this stuff. And in the end, it turned out to be this very quiet, very, very quiet book that was not plotted at all, but it's just sort of like put together by some sort of poetic juxtaposition. So I have a plan, and the plan will get changed and changed and changed and changed, and eventually thrown away, and hopefully something better comes along. And if that something better comes along, then again, that's usually a good sign. If I know everything that's going to be in a book, I probably am not going to write that book because I can already see it too well. I want it to be a mystery. I want it to develop. I want it to be a process of discovery as I'm going through it. I have a very short attention span, I think. And people ask, you know, why your book's very different. Again, I have a very short attention span, and I like to read lots of different kinds of books, so it makes sense that I would write lots of different kinds of books. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. Thank you. And please support your public library.
And in case you didn't catch it, Stuart Onan shared his nightstand reads on our blog, Shelf Talk, so check that out.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.